its current state on 90.5 WKAR. A friendly reminder for those of you planning on attending the Great Lakes Folk Festival Friday night. Current state is taking the show on the road live Friday night between 6 and 7 o'clock. So we will be looking for you amidst the music and the artisans and the craft work and everything else that is a part of the Great Lakes Folk Festival this Friday night. We are looking forward to it an awful lot. We've got a pretty good show here for you today. Coolio, you remember Gangsta's Paradise from a few years back. He is performing in Lansing at the Loft. Scott Pohl visited with Coolio. That's coming up later this hour. And for those of you who caught Louise Knott Ahern's tremendous story in Sunday's Lansing State Journal about Tashmika Torok, founder of the Firecracker Project. Tashmika joins us later this hour as well here on Current State. Voters have now determined who will be in November's general election for the Lansing City Council. Last night, at large aspirants Judy Brown Clark and Ted Odell were among the top four finishers. That means they will compete with the two successful incumbents, Brian Jeffries and Kathy Dunbar, for two seats this fall. In the 4th Ward last night, incumbent Jessica Yorko prevailed, along with challenger Chong Anna Canfora, and they will face each other in 3 months as well. And we welcome two of those three successful challengers to Current State to talk about what they've learned so far and what lay ahead. Chong Anna Canfora, congratulations.
Thank you very much, Mark.
And Ted Odell, congratulations to you.
Good morning. Thank you.
Nice to see you again. Judy Brown Clark hopefully will join us shortly. How confident were you going into last night, Ted?
Pretty confident. Our goal was to come through the primary and place either first, second, third, or fourth, and we certainly did that. And now, as of today, we hit the reset button and start all over for November.
You finished fourth, and you needed to finish in the top four.
Correct.
Are you reassured, or are you concerned about the margins there?
I'm actually feeling pretty good.
Judy Brown Clark rolled up a lot of votes.
Yes, she did. I'm feeling pretty good. We spent about $3,000. Our opponents outspent us about 4-1, but we decided to simply knock on doors for the primary election, and then we'll be spending our resources for the general election.
Judy Brown Clark, as a matter of fact, who will hopefully join us shortly, as I said, came fairly close to finishing second, but in the end, the two incumbents did finish 1-2. Chong Anna, how did you feel going into last night?
Well, we felt great. We always understood that this was a David and Goliath type situation whenever you're taking on an incumbent. And we're very, very pleased with the diversity of support that we got from a wide coalition of different folks. And really, really pleased that we're going to go on to compete in November.
I'll point out that the two top candidates for mayor have also been determined, as you likely know, Virge Brunero, the incumbent, and Harold Lehman Jr. But we're going to confine this segment to our city council hopefuls here, the challengers. I'd like to start by asking you, Chong Anna, how you now intend to win in November and keep this streak going. What buttons do you push to win in November?
Well, essentially this is, winning hearts and minds voter by voter. So it's really, talking to voters, continuing to knock on doors. We started canvassing back in April, talking to voters and, presenting myself, introducing me to them, what I have to offer as a candidate, as a neighbor, and really continuing that conversation. What I have found in knocking on all of these doors is that I learned so much from listening to folks, not so much going into a long spiel about me, but really asking them questions about what they expect to see and what they want from their city government. And it has been a hugely eye-opening experience. It's confirmed a lot of the things that I thought, but it's also opened up a lot of great conversations about accountability, about transparency, about things that people want from their city government.
What was the most eye-opening thing you learned about the 4th Ward in this process?
Honestly, one of the most eye-opening things is that people want city government to focus on and get the basics right. They want good roads. They want good sidewalks. They want safe, neighborhoods. And if those basic things are not being taken care of and visibly taken care of, if they do not feel like that quality of life in their neighborhoods and in their community is being taken care of, all the other stuff is sort of window dressing to
are
them.
Are there doubts about Jessica Yorko's performance in that role?
I think that there is a strong desire for change in representation at City Council. I think there is a strong desire for folks to have someone who they feel like they can count on, who is going to be there for them, who's going to be their seat at the table, be their voice, and who's going to speak up even when it's not politically convenient.
Ted O'Dell, unlike Chong Anna, you're up against three people in November. What buttons do you push to win?
There's a whole number of buttons we'll be pushing. We'll be focusing on heavy door-to-door activity throughout the city. We'll be focusing on direct mail and getting out to meet the voters. I would add to Chong Anna's comment, she's absolutely right. There's a real need for change in our city, and I think there's a real need for independent voices on the city council. Along with the issues that Chong Anna had spoke about, I would add to that clean, safe parks. That's another huge issue that I hear almost daily as knocking on doors, along with police officers on the streets and firefighters and fire trucks, the basics that we all expect when we pay our taxes.
How much do you intend to discuss your opponents, Ted?
I'll be discussing my opponent, and I've sort of singled out one of the current incumbents by the name of Kathy Dunbar, simply because she has missed more than 30% of the city council meetings in her tenure, and she has missed a greater number of committee meetings. And I just don't see how it's possible to be an effective voice for the citizens when you're not even in the room.
Chong Anna, do you intend to discuss Jessica Yorko's record in any detail?
Well, I think that it is important that voters understand the different, skill sets and record that we bring to the table. And
what do you bring to the table that Jessica doesn't?
Well, one of the things that I bring to the table is, we have a different perception, I think, of what being progressive is. Some folks have asked, why would you challenge another progressive candidate? Progressive to me means speaking truth to power. Progressive to me means understanding the diversity of the community that you represent and representing everybody, understanding that every neighborhood has a voice, not just focusing on representing those that already have wealth, already have power, and are already, politically influential.
Ted O'Dell, over what kinds of issues do you see yourself resisting the Bernero administration, assuming Virge Bernero is reelected in November? Over what kinds of issues do you see yourself resisting the administration if you're successful?
Sure. I don't know if resisting the mayor is actually a good term for me. I've known the mayor since the day he was hired by a former state senator. He and I both worked together in the state legislature years ago. And I think he's a pretty good guy. And given the cards he's been dealt as mayor, he's done a pretty good job overall. But I do believe there needs to be more independent voices on the council. I do believe there's some shell games going on with city finances at City Hall, specifically with the police department. I think we need to look into that issue and make sure that our dollars are being spent the best way possible.
What can you go a little deeper on that? What
sure.
Tell us about this shell game at the police department.
Absolutely. One of the issues that I've been talking to folks with at the doors is that last year the citizens in the city of Lansing voted to raise our own taxes to fund police and fire and to raise additional revenue. A portion of that money, about $400,000, is currently being held hostage by the mayor because they're in negotiations with the police department right now. And the mayor's team is demanding a $700,000 concession from the police department. The officers have said, no way, we're not going to do that. And we as citizens voted to tax ourselves to fund the police officers. And I want to make sure that happens and that those monies go to where they are intended.
So money that was approved by the voters is just being held right now and not being invested.
Correct. It's a negotiation tactic.
That's what you're
tactic.
Alleging.
Yes, it's okay. A negotiation tactic by the administration currently, and I think that needs to stop.
Okay. Chong Anna, is that on your radar?
It's definitely on my radar that, you know, the incumbent, you know, claims that she has a strong public safety record, but in fact, in 2011, you know, voted to for a budget that cut, you know, 36 police officers and 11 firefighters. That's something that the Fraternal Order of Police and others have pointed out about my opponent's record, and it's something that I think is very important to consider.
Can I get either of you to admit that you'd like to reverse the mayor's veto-proof majority?
I would say, to be a successful candidate for public office and to be a successful proponent of citizens, I think you need to be open-minded. You know, my background is in labor negotiations and labor relations. So I've had the experiences of taking two sides that are, you know, miles apart and trying to bring them together on any specific issue so we can move forward for the greater good of the community. I feel as though I can work with the mayor. I can certainly work with the thought leaders on council. And in my opinion, I'm not there to soak up the limelight. I just want to get things done for the citizens because I, like many of your listeners, have a vested interest in seeing Lansing do well. I live here. I work here. I play here. I intend to retire here. So I want to do whatever I can to move the city forward.
But do you see yourself as a likely member of the Wood Jeffries faction on city council, I guess, just to cut right to the chase?
Well, I'd like to, you know, say that the only faction that I'm interested in representing is the citizens of the 4th Ward. I'm running because I want to be a voice for all of our neighborhoods and for our ward. You know, I feel like the media and maybe even sometimes the mayor have tried to sort of oversimplify and, you know, create for dramatic effect that this is about the mayor's veto power because it's a good headline or a good hook. And the fact is that, you know, government is created, it was created to have checks and balances. And the ward advocates and the at-large candidates as well, council people, were put in place to be a voice for the people so that people could have input into their government. So when, you know, the administration or, you know, other council people are advocating for policies that are going to benefit the city and particularly the 4th Ward, those are the policies that I'm going to want to support. I don't care, you know, who the source of the idea is. I want to move the ball forward. I want to keep the city growing and really fight for quality of life issues.
We are talking with Ted O'Dell and Chong Anna Canfora, who were both successful last night in their bids to make it to the November general election for Lansing City Council. Last Friday here on Current State, Anita Beavers, a former neighborhood leader in Colonial Village, urged more cohesiveness on the council. Here she is referring to the often heard complaint by some city council members that important information they've requested is late.
I don't know how often it happens, but they'll be asking for information and they don't have it. They'll get some, and it's last minute from the administration. So they're having to work hard to make decisions. And I feel sometimes that it's just a matter of when and how can you work together instead of continuing to say, no, it's going to be my way.
Any thoughts on cohesiveness on the council? Ted, you've alluded to that already
certainly,
this morning.
Certainly. I think there has been some issues between council members and the administrative office, i.e. the mayor. Anita is very correct. A number of issues that are large, important issues for the city. I'll mention the Nile Wave project, for example, in the Walnut neighborhood. Basically, a pole barn has been built in the middle of a historic neighborhood. There were some issues there. There were some budgetary issues here just several weeks back where information requested by the council from the mayor's office came in at the last minute. And most recently, the issue with LGBT rights in Russia, and there was a resolution that's being offered by Councilwoman Jody Washington, who was under the impression she had the support of the mayor's office. And that evening at the city council meeting, the mayor's people did a complete 360 on council and said, oh, no, we don't think this is the way to go. We should continue our relationship in the Sister Cities program with St. Petersburg, Russia. So I think there's been a lot of game playing on the side of the mayor, and that's not—it's not fair to the people. You know, it's not fair to the process. I'm a huge proponent of data-driven quality debate before you make a decision, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Chong Anna, what do you make of the allegations that the administration it's manipulative? It withholds information. It's late with information. That it plays this game.
Mm-hmm. I think Anita's comments really reflect a desire by everyday people, everyday city residents that want to know that we're playing with an even playing field, that, you know, city council people and the administration are working off the same information, that they're, you know, working cooperatively. They expect, you know, all the folks at the table to act like grown-ups, and to be responsible, and for their agenda to be to move the city forward, to set the egos aside, and to make sure that they're really pursuing the best possible relationship so we can get things done for the city.
Chong Anna Canfora is a candidate for Lansing's 4th Ward for the Lansing City Council. Ted O'Dell is one of four candidates for the at-large positions on the Lansing City Council. You will see their names on the ballot this November. I wish we had more time. We'll have you back between now and November. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark.
It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Experts in suicide prevention tend to focus their outreach efforts on two segments of the population, young adults and the elderly. But shifting data from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have some professionals reconsidering that approach. Last month, statistics showed a 60% increase in suicide among women in their early 60s and a 50% spike among men in their 50s. The data covers the calendar year 2010. We thought we'd try to learn more and to see if and how this grim trend might be playing out here in mid-Michigan. Here to share her insights is Dr. Tanya Sivier, a psychologist with Community Mental Health in Lansing. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
What did you think when you first heard of this spike in middle-aged suicide?
I'm truly not surprised, given the economy and the access to prescription drugs and the increase and such. Again, most of the research has indicated in the past that the trend has been adolescents and 65 years and older mm-hmm. have been most at risk. But as you stated, there has been a significant increase in the baby boomers. Still, the use of firearms and suffocation, which is hanging, seem to be dominant, and that's dominant within the male population.
Okay.
They tend to use more lethal means,
okay,
where poisoning is more of a trend of the female population.
For some perspective, we should point out that even among these demographics that have seen these spikes, okay, the 50-something men and the early 60s women, the incidence is still hardly common. The incidence among early 60s women, for example, up 60%, but that's up to 7 per 1,000. Not insignificant, but hardly a contagion either. That said, the numbers among 50-something men are higher. That 50% jump takes it up to 30 suicides per 100,000. You alluded to economic pressures mm-hmm. and to subscription drug use. Tell us a little bit more about that. How do you see economic pressures playing into this?
Well, one of the most common risk factors of assessing suicidality is losses, such as job loss, stresses such as financial stressors. People are losing their homes, they're losing their jobs, they're losing their retirement. Things are just much more difficult out there.
Mm-hmm.
So they're looking more towards a permanent solution rather than a temporary solution, which is suicide.
And they see their future is seriously compromised financially.
Yes.
In many. And you also mentioned drug use as
well. And what I've seen in my profession is the increase in opiate use, prescription drug use.
Antidepressants or...
Yeah, we see that too, but I see a great increase in the opiate use, the pain medications.
Oh, okay.
So Vicodin and such. So.
And what else? What else might be going on? I know the Centers for Disease Control alluded to the number of baby boomers caring for aging parents as well. Do you see that?
That's another stressor. I mean, you know, having an elderly family member in your household can cause much stress.
Mm-hmm.
Watching them die can cause a lot of stress,
of
depression.
Of course. So. The report also alluded to growing isolation related to the internet. In other words, people are just obsessed with their portable electronic devices and really, in the process, a lot less connected to other human beings.
Right. I mean, if you sit around anywhere, you see everybody is looking at their phone, texting, Facebooking. They're not necessarily communicating with the person next to them. And as human beings, we're social and... we really need that connection. So, and this kind of distance.
I'm sometimes amazed at how much less I am acquainted with my neighbors in my neighborhood too. It's not necessarily an internet driven thing, but as neighbors, as communities, mm-hmm. there seems to be a growing isolation here.
Absolutely.
Too. You would agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think most people that are connected with a social group, such as through a church, mm-hmm. rather than through the neighborhood.
Okay.
There's not, I don't see as many neighborhood gatherings necessarily,
mm-hmm.
so as we probably did in the past.
Interestingly, I see that there have been more suicides among baby boomers. That's the generation born between 1946 and 1964, all along. We saw quite a spike here in this report last month, but if you track that group through the years, there have been more suicides among baby boomers. Any idea as to why?
I think that probably in our culture it's becoming more acceptable, would be my guess. If you look at the trends, Caucasian men are usually highest risk. Native Americans are higher risk, Alaskan Natives, but I think that has to do with their cultural acceptance of suicide.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think as the internet grows and our knowledge base is out there and how we see the future, it can be dismal for mm-hmm. many people. So that increases...
Do you see these factors impacting the discussion of assisted suicide? As a professional, what do you make of the discussion of assisted suicide?
Again, that's a permanent solution to a temporary problem, and everybody's journey's their own. So,
what do you make of the states that have made it more acceptable?
Again, our society is more acceptable to many things, I think, including suicide. Suicide used to be something that nobody talked about. It's still very underreported,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think we're as shocked when we hear about it anymore. So, and part of it is because the discussion on assisted suicide. And if you think about the elderly population, 65 years of age and older, living longer but not necessarily healthier, they just seem to be living longer, maybe in a compromised state of health, it becomes more of an option for people because they don't want to live like that.
Yeah. Dr. Tanya Sivier is a psychologist with Community Mental Health. We've been discussing the latest statistics from the CDC regarding suicides among middle-aged people. Tanya, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Coolio got his start in the Los Angeles rap music scene in the late 80s and early 90s, and he hit it big when the producers of the movie Dangerous Minds chose his song Gangsta's Paradise for the soundtrack. It went to the top of the charts and won him the Grammy Award for the Best Solo Rap Performance back in 1996. In all, Coolio has sold 30 million records worldwide. Coolio will be in Lansing for a concert at the Loft Thursday night, and Current State Scott Pohl talked with Coolio last week. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Mark. How you doing?
Real good.
Good.
Tell us what Coolio has been up to lately.
Well, you know, last week, Coolio turned 50 on the day after we spoke. It was one of those morning edition birthday announcements, and I heard it the day after he and I spoke. I wish I'd known when, when I was talking with him that he was about to turn 50. He's still touring, still recording. His most recent album is called From the Bottom to the Top. It came out in 2009. He's done some acting, and he's also into some other things these days, as you'll hear. You'll have to listen closely. We didn't have a very good phone connection. You might want to turn your radio up to hear our conversation. He told me about getting interested in rapping in the late 80s and early 90s when the early records by Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five and Run DMC came out. He did it for fun, he says, and it took a while to discover that he could make a living as a rapper.
I think in the beginning I wasn't really worried about making money in it. And you know, I saw people around me they're starting to become successful in it, and it wasn't probably until the mid 90s where I thought maybe, you know, to give it a shot to try to make money from it.
And was it fun?
Absolutely. I mean, it's still fun. I mean, I wouldn't say so much I like the business so much. I mean, I like the actual act of rapping, you know, like being on stage and doing it live and watching people's reactions to it.
Were you ever part of that West Coast, East Coast rivalry?
Everybody was. I mean, you had to be. I mean, you had to pick a side. And so I think, yeah, maybe I was a little bit.
You were able to avoid the violence that was associated with it.
I had a lot of friends from the East Coast, so that kind of, you know, that kept it in perspective for me.
Does it linger to this day with anyone?
No, not at all. Not at all.
You really hit it big with Gangsta's Paradise from the movie Dangerous Minds. I wanted to ask you if you think the song made the movie or did the movie make the song?
I think they each made each other. Yeah, I think it worked really well together.
Money and the power, minute after minute, hour after hour, everybody's running, but half of them ain't looking at what's going on in the kitchen, but I don't know what's cooking. They say I got to learn, but nobody's here to teach me. If they can't understand it, how can they reach me? I guess they can't, I guess they won't, I guess they front, that's why I know my life is out of luck, fool.
Everybody had their own interpretation of what the song was. The original interpretation for me was, I kind of thought it was about the hood and about the way things went on when the door was closed. But I think that once the song came out, even my opinion of what the definition of it was changed. which in my definition of it became whatever the individual feels that it is.
Did the movie people come to you because you already had this song, or did you write it for the film?
Well, no, they came to my manager, and he was really successful at the time because he had just got a lot of people, you know, record deals. And they asked him what kind of music he had, and so he started playing some stuff, and he played Gangsta's Paradise. And it was a lady named Kathy Green that did musical acquisitions for Disney. She said, oh, my God, I love this song, and I want it, just like that.
I have to ask you what you thought of the Weird Al Yankovic parody, Amish Paradise.
In the beginning, I wasn't too happy with that. But, you know, I think that was one of the mistakes I made in my career, was even saying something about that. If I could go back, I'd take that back. And, you know, I mean, who am I? You know, Weird Al did, Michael Jackson, he did, Prince, he did. I mean, this wasn't right. I shouldn't have said anything.
You know, I don't usually ask artists about their hair, but you've really maintained a distinctive look. Where did that look come from?
It just happened, you know. I used to get my hair braided down, and in 3 days it'd be sticking up. So one day I told the girl, I said, no, man, I'm so tired of this. I said, braid it all up then. And that's how I started.
I'd like to hear what you think about how rap and hip-hop music have evolved over the last couple of decades that you've been in the business.
Well, I think it's evolved some for the better, some for the worse. I don't think that the whole spectrum of what hip hop could be is it's not well. I mean, it's too one sided. People need to start rapping about more different things so that we keep that 360 degree circumference around the music. And right now it's not.
The biggest rap stars these days are people like Jay-Z and Eminem and Kanye West. How do you think they stand up against predecessors from your era?
You know, I mean, they're okay. But to me, I think they're reasonable facsimile. You know, I don't think they're a genuine article. They're good, and that's all I can say. But I just don't think they don't take it serious enough. They rap for money. We rap because we love to rap. And I think they rap more for the money than anything. Except for Eminem. You know, I say Eminem does it from the heart.
How do you stay fresh after all these years, a couple of decades under your belt as a rapper? How do you maintain your energy level? How do you stay fresh?
Well, you know, I got my nephew around me all the time, my son, and they rap. And, you know, I got some young cats, some young boys in the hip-hop. And it's three generations of hip-hop in my family now, my nephew, my son, and me.
And you're mentoring younger rappers then?
Absolutely. And they mentoring me back.
There are a couple of things outside of music that you've gotten involved in that I'd like to hear about. One is the Beatmaker app that you have at the Apple Store. Can you tell me more about that?
Well, actually, I think it could have been a lot better. And we're trying to, right now, we're trying to revamp it and make it easier to use and a lot more fun. And, you know, hopefully somebody will make a hit song with my Beatmaker. In the beginning, I thought it was just a little difficult to use. So, like I said, we're just looking to make it easier now.
Dating back to like 2008, 2009, you started getting involved with cooking. You put out a book called Cooking with Coolio, 5-star meals at a 1-star price. You have a YouTube channel of Cooking with Coolio. How did you get interested in cooking?
I've been cooking since I was a little boy. You know, the last decade or so, I just got more into it. You know, my mother passed away, and that's probably the biggest thing that got me into it. I just wanted to eat again. I wanted to enjoy my food again, and I wanted things to taste like my mother's. And I knew that, you know, if I wanted that, I was going to have to learn how to do it myself.
Do you dip into your mom's recipe box?
Well, you know, I couldn't find my mom's recipe box, so I just had to start asking people, how did my mom do this? How did my mom do that? And then from that, I got what her basic schemes were, and then I was able to figure it out after that.
Well, listen, Coolio, thank you so much. I hope folks will stop by the Loft in Lansing on Thursday the 8th to check you out. I'm really glad we had a chance to talk.
That'll do, man.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
And Coolio appears Thursday night at the Loft on East Michigan Avenue in Lansing. Doors open at 8 p.m. It's Wednesday and time for our Neighbors in Action segment, when Current State features people and organizations working to make our community a better place. This week we feature the newly launched nonprofit called the Firecracker Project. It seeks to provide therapy and support for victims of child sexual abuse. Here to tell us more about the Firecracker Project is the project's founder, the Firecracker herself, Tashmika Torok. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you for having me.
You just had your launch party last week. Tell us about the Firecracker Project. What are its main goals?
Well, the Firecracker Foundation's mission is to honor the bravery of children who have survived sexual trauma. So we are looking to provide free, quality, and consistent counseling for children who don't have access to it.
There was a very personal, very compelling, and emotional story about you in last Sunday's Lansing State Journal. You come at this with significant personal experience. Tell us your story, if you would.
I was sexually abused by my father, so I am an incest survivor as well as a sexual abuse survivor, from the ages of 6 until he passed away when I was 8. So I grew up without access to counseling, mostly because we didn't know I needed it, didn't understand the consequences of sexual trauma, especially going untreated. And so I dealt with issues of, you know, PTSD, not being able to sleep, connections with other people, depression, a lot of different things. But I didn't really understand that that was in, something that impacted me from sexual trauma.
And then one day there was a real turning point for you in your schooling. Someone came to your classroom. Tell us what happened.
When I was 9 years old, my father had been dead a year, and I had a person come to my classroom and give us the good touch, bad touch talk. And for the first time in my life, I had some type of a definition of what had happened to me, and I realized that I had been sexually abused. And my teacher, Mrs. Pease, who I absolutely adored, was there, and he, you know, the guy said, raise your hand if this has happened to you, and I didn't trust him, didn't know him from Adam, so I didn't raise my hand. But I waited, and I waited long enough for the class to settle back down, and then I called her over, and I asked her, you know, I whispered, can I talk to you in private? And she said yes, and then I told her, and her words to me immediately were, it happened to me, you're going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And so ever since that moment, between her and my mother believing me right away, and then a very beautiful line of women being able to pour good things to me into me over the years, I think that's how I survived.
What years were the most difficult? What did you struggle with specifically the most?
Nobody likes middle school, right? I mean, middle school, if you ask any adult, no one ever wants to go back to middle school. It's the worst time of your life. But having to go through middle school and parts of high school feeling abnormal, not understanding, you know, when people are talking about that girl who, you know, is having sex and, you know, how promiscuous she is, and then, you know, calling her horrible names, and then you're trying to pretend like you have no idea what they're talking about because you don't want to be, you know, too virginal, but you don't want to let on that you have experienced everything. And to make it worse, you've experienced everything with your own father. So that was really difficult. And having children was difficult in some ways. You know, making sure that they are safe is an impossibility that I grapple with a lot. You know,
that is a tremendous preoccupation for you.
Yeah.
Is that it?
Yeah, I've dealt with it over the years, and I'm more comfortable with it, but that initial pregnancy and then realizing that at some point they are going to be outside of my body and have a personal experience and a life that is not connected to mine at any given time and that I can't protect them is a pretty tremendous burden for someone who was victimized in private for many, you know, for 2 years without anybody knowing.
The ruse that your father used all those years ago was to go stargazing out in the desert. You grew up in Texas, and you would go out into the desert and stargaze. I have to say, visually, one of the most compelling things about the Louise Knott Ahern's treatment of your story in Sunday's Lansing State Journal was the image of you on the front page of the paper with your Google app or your iPad app, mm-hmm. Using the Stargazer app.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to us about, did that represent a real resolution to your story?
I think it represents that regardless of my childhood, regardless of what I've survived, I am so grateful that I am still able to live in wonder of the stars. My father had a tremendous opportunity to ruin a lot of things for me. But what I tell people often is that he didn't own the stars. You know, they were there long before he was. So all of the things that he tried to ruin, you know, including my personal legacy and my personal story, you know, I've been able to completely turn around and enjoy and love life and love it lavishly. And that's a gift that I was able to give to myself in a lot of ways and that other people who loved me were able to give me. So, yeah, so, I mean, the stars, Orion is my favorite constellation, always will be. But, yeah, my father taught it to me. And so there is that undercurrent of my personal story that will always be there.
If I have it correct, one of the interesting details of Sunday's story as well was that you were a breech baby.
Yeah.
Born facing up.
I wasn't born breech, but I was born facing up, and they call babies like that stargazing. And I actually didn't know that. When I named the event, I named it specifically about stargazing, about being able to live in wonder of the stars. But when I was talking to my mother and doing research, my mother said to me that I was actually, she reminded me of something that she told me before and that I'd been born stargazing.
When you went through your therapy, what did it entail exactly?
You know, actually, I went to therapy at first for marriage counseling. You know, me and my husband went after every child, and a lot of that was connected to having a baby, and we've already talked about that a little bit. But around the third time, I started to realize that there were things from my past that were directly affecting our marriage. And so we started to go separately, and I went specifically to deal with issues related to the sexual trauma. So a lot of talking about memories, a lot of realizations about, you know, you feel dirty and kind of coming clean, you know, and feeling like you releasing that imagery of yourself as a dirty individual or someone who's broken or you know, although you will always have scars, it's not something that negates who you are mm-hmm. and what you're able to do in your life. You know, and one of the most impactful things was even being shown basically a chart of what sexual trauma looks like from its most severe forms to, you know, what people would consider mild. And, of course, sexual trauma is severe and the consequences are severe regardless.
But you I mean had symptoms?
Well, not symptoms. It was mostly like what acts had been perpetrated against me.
Oh.
And I had no idea that my what I'd experienced was on the higher end of severe trauma. There's very little things on that chart that had not happened to me. And so I felt justified. You know, I felt like I'd gone through all of these things thinking that why can I not get over this? Like, why is this such a huge deal in my life and why do I keep going back to this? And a lot of it was because I was severely sexually traumatized and I didn't even know until I was 30 that there was even a chart that existed.
Oh, my. How do you encourage other victims to speak out, to do something?
Well, I tell my story. I tell my story. And I get messages all the time when I first started telling my story that I can't, you know, women would send me messages that would say, you know, I can't speak out because of these reasons, so I appreciate your voice. And so that's one way. I think people who have their own personal reasons why they can't tell their story really appreciate hearing it. Also, I really believe, and especially in the course of the past weeks, that there are people like me that are kind of waiting in the wings that really know this struggle on a deep level and haven't really found a place to use that energy, you know, that to find a way to make something good. And I'm hoping that the Firecracker Foundation will build a community of survivors and advocates that can kind of come together on behalf of children that are living the same struggle that we've survived, basically.
I can't imagine how profound that good touch, bad touch lesson that day must have been as you sat out there as an 8-year-old girl.
Yeah.
That is, I can't get my head around that.
It was just, you know, it was almost the same as seeing that chart for the first time. You know, you just go through, especially at 9, especially before the age of Google and Oprah, you know, don't know what sexual abuse is. You shouldn't at the age of 9. And so the first time somebody names it, it's almost like being diagnosed with a serious disease that you've been dealing with for years, but you didn't know the symptoms.
Yeah.
You know, and then all of a sudden now you know. And I always tell people I would choose knowledge over anything. Like, mm-hmm. if I could just know what it is so I can deal with it, that's better than not knowing.
Better than ignorance.
Yeah, right. Definitely.
What are your ultimate goals for the Firecracker project?
My ultimate goal in 2014 is to provide 5 children with high-quality, consistent counseling. So that would be $100 per month for a full year for each child. On top of that, I want to raise money so that we can be sustainable for many, many years moving forward. My goal is $75,000 in 2014. I'd love to be able to provide arts and sports counseling, or not counseling, but programs, so art therapy, music therapy, involved in physical activities, which will build on the work that we provide them in counseling. Mm-hmm. And then my dreams go on and on forever for this foundation. I would love to have survivors that are working with our organization to help us create these programs. I would love to have, you know, group therapy sessions and for children who are survivors, but also for their parents to help them work through the many issues that they're going to have to deal with over time.
How would you assess existing programs, the programs that are already out there to help people?
You know, the one wonderful thing about living in Lansing is that we love our children, right? I mean, we've got so many great programs out there for kids. We've got Ellie's Place. We've got, you know, Reach Art Studio. We've all of these beautiful, beautiful programs. The one thing that I feel like is missing and is that it's not, oh, for counseling specifically, children who don't have access to insurance can't afford this type of counseling, and most children who are abused are living in poverty. So their parents don't have access to this kind of care.
Yeah.
And I want to make sure that we are providing something that's long-term, which is also something when it comes to counseling, it's usually 2 to 3 months based on what programs can fund. So I want to identify individual children and provide them with the counseling they need for at least a year.
Yours is an extraordinary story. We thank you very much for joining us. Tashmika Torok is the founder of Lansing's newest nonprofit, the Firecracker Project. Thank you, Tashmika, and good luck.
Thank you.
We could always use more nominations, and we know that there are great people and organizations out there that are doing excellent work. We just don't know about them. If you'd like one to be featured on our Neighbors in Action segment, please send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work that they do. It's Current State here on WKAR. All this week, 395 athletes from 17 nations have been competing in 14 events all over the MSU campus and the Lansing area as part of the 2013 World Dwarf Games. The very concept of competitive athletics among dwarves was conceived right here in East Lansing nearly 30 years ago. It's evolved into this week's international competition, which is the largest of its kind in history. WKAR and Current State decided to do something special to commemorate the occasion, and here to tell us a little bit more is Current State producer Joe Lindstroff. Hi,
well,
Joe.
Hello, Mark. How are you?
I'm great.
Yeah, you know, when we learned about this history here in Lansing and Michigan State University with dwarf athletics and dwarf competition, you know, I decided that we really need to do something and celebrate this. Also, to capture the international buzz, you know, all these kinds of sporting events, the World Cup, the Olympics, there really is an unmatched electricity when you have people from all over the world gather to compete.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same here with the World Dwarf Games. Myself, Emmanuel Berry, producer, and production assistant Becky McKendry, spent the weekend with the competitors, with the athletes and their families. And we partnered with a Chicago-based photographer named John Patrick McGuire, very talented photographer. And we set up a portrait studio, and we took well over 40 portraits of the athletes. Beautiful, beautiful photographs.
They are great.
And we interviewed some of the athletes as well. And we put it together in a multimedia presentation to celebrate the games here, to celebrate the athletes. And we finally have finished it after many long hours, and it's online at WKAR.org, right on the homepage. I really do strongly encourage you to have a look at this. I think that perhaps by viewing this, you might want to come out and take a look at some of the events. There are some incredible athletes here, some Paralympians. The finals of powerlifting are Friday, basketball at Breslin Center on Saturday. Just as a little sample to kind of lure you to the web and check out our multimedia, we have a few voices here that you can hear from the athletes.
I'm Rachel Chung. I'm from Great Britain, and I play badminton and discus javelin, floor hockey, basketball, football, and table tennis. It's brilliant. Like, within your day-to-day life, you don't get to see, or you may not see very many other dwarves, so you get to chill out with some people that are the same height. You're not always looking up, like, straining your neck.
My name is Jeffrey Aston. I'm from Huntington Wood, Michigan. I will be playing basketball and volleyball, and I am, as far as I understand, the only MSU student here. For me, it's interesting. I've never been around a whole bunch of people my size and a whole bunch of dwarves. There weren't any of those people in my community, and I haven't seen many people here at MSU, so now it's a whole new world. I'm meeting new people within my community and international, and it means a lot, and I hope to keep in touch with them.
I'm Nalini Arunachalam. I'm from India. I play badminton, shot put, discus. I have come here, enjoyed with my kind of people. Otherwise, I would never meet this kind of people anywhere. So here I saw at least thousands of people or hundreds of people here together. It's really awesome. So I feel good because otherwise, when we are with the normal people, we feel a little bit low. Why? Because why God created us like this? But now, when I'm among these kind of people, my kind of people, like mine, and same structure and all, so I feel, no, there are a lot of people like me, and still they are enjoying life. So I should also enjoy life. Nothing to worry about being like this.
And that's our show for today. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.